be seated. Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals sitting at Texas A&M School of Law. We are very pleased to be here this morning, and we have two very interesting cases set for oral argument. I understand the lawyers have announced ready and the time that they would like to argue. So if our clerk will call the first case.
May it please the court. I'll be happy to discuss facts if the court wishes, but I will refrain unless you have a question about those. As attorney for the heirs in this case, we have two basic arguments. Number one, that the construction of the will at the time the court construed it was premature because it had not yet been admitted to probate. And secondly, that the trial court under case law cannot rewrite a will. It's got to interpret the will according to its terms. The fact statement does show that while the will was initially admitted to probate by a prior judge of the court, it was set aside by agreement, so that at the time of the summary judgment hearing, there was no will admitted to probate. An application had been filed, but no admission. We cited a couple of cases for the court, Cowan versus Cowan, Jackson versus Thompson. The Cowan case said that a will not yet admitted to probate is simply a purported question and cannot be decided in a deck action. In the Jackson case, the will had actually been admitted into evidence as an exhibit, but had not been admitted to probate. And the court said that it had no effect on the decedent's assets because it had not been admitted to probate. We pointed that out to the trial court, and it's also been briefed. While a declaratory judgment's action by statute, section 37.004, can interpret a will, it must be admitted to probate. Now, in the appellee's brief, there was a claim that a case called Estate of Florence allowed the court, a court, to construe a will pre-admission. The Florence case does not say that. And we pointed that out in our reply brief. In the appellee's surreply brief, they again cited section 37.004 of the declaratory judgment statute as evidence that, hey, it says a will, so the court ought to be able to construe a will. But as I argued to the trial court, section 94 of the probate code, and I will refer to the probate code because of the fact that this contest was pending before the estates code became effective, but it is 256.001 of the estates code as well. Section 94 says that a will is not effective for any purpose until it's been admitted to probate. In fact, the statute itself says no will shall be effectual for the purpose of proving title to or the right to possession of any real or personal property disposed of by the will until such will has been admitted to probate.
But Mr. Brannion?
Yes.
Isn't the Cowan case distinguishable factually from the case here? Because in Cowan, the testator had not yet died. So they were seeking to construe a will where the testator had not yet died.
Absolutely, and there's a specific statute in both the probate code and now in the estates code that says you can't probate a will before somebody died, and you can't construe one either. But the fact remains, it still had not been admitted to probate at the time the court was asked to construe it, and that's the same point that we're making here.
But the issue of ripeness was that it wasn't right because the testator had not died, and here the testator had asked.
Yes, and I agree with the court with that statement. That is what the Cowan court was faced with, and there's a separate statute in the estates code that says you can't admit a will or construe it before it's admitted. But I think the point is still the same. You certainly have to have a dead testator, and you have to have a will admitted based again on section 94 and also on the Jackson case. And I'll also cite a case, Morrison versus Brewster and Mayhall, 773 Southwest 2nd, 607, an El Paso 1989 case, no writ, where the same issue was examined. And the court there said several things that were interesting after citing section 94 of the probate code. It said, during the interim between a testator's death and the filing and or admitting of a will to probate, The legal effect is that the decedent died intestate. So the relief requested by the appellee before the trial court was, we want all the property because we believe the will left all the property to appellee. Well, that's exactly what the Mayhall case says you can't do, because there's no presumption that just because a will has been typed up that it's valid and admissible. And the analogy I would give to the court is, it's like a default judgment that a trial court takes before service has been had on a defendant. It's void. It doesn't matter if service is obtained later. You can't default somebody who hasn't been served. Now, the appellee says that we can't point, we being the appellants, can't point to authority that says the court cannot construe the will pre-admission. Well, number one, we think we have cited authority that says that. But I also believe that misplaces the burden of proof, because the appellee went to the trial court and said, we want relief. We want relief in the form of all the property, because that's how we read the will. So I submit to this court that we as appellants don't need to show that the court cannot. Instead, the appellee needs to show that the court can, and I don't believe that has been proven. Now, the second argument, the second principal part of the argument, is if the court believes, as the trial court did, that we can construe this will, even though it has not been admitted to probate, I put on the screen and submitted to the justices the provision, Article 3 of the will. Now, the appellee cited a case, Hysaw, in their SIR reply brief that says the court can take language from various places in a will and lay it over a part that may be a little confusing and construe it. And I submit that that's not what the Hysaw case said. It's a very interesting case. I don't think I've ever read an appellate opinion that quotes both Ben Franklin and J.R. Ewing, but it does. Now, the Hysaw case, though, dealt with fractions of mineral bequests. And it dealt with bequests in three places to the same group of people, yet the bequests themselves are worded differently. So there was no question in the Hysaw case that dealt with deceased beneficiaries or the potential of lapsed bequests that we have here. We cited the Flores case that says a decedent is presumed under law to understand exactly what is written in a will and what the contents are. The court is directed to focus on intent as expressed and to harmonize all the parts, not try to determine what the testator may have intended to write, but what the testator did in fact write. Now, sections A and B, we contend, are lapsed bequests. A simply says basically that the homestead was to pass to Glenn Rhodes. Glenn predeceased his daughter. If Glenn had descendants, the anti-lapse statute, section 68 of the probate code, would say that the lapsed bequest would pass to Glenn Rhodes' descendants. But Glenn didn't have any other descendants, so that the anti-lapse statute does not save that bequest. It lapses. And the language in the will does not say where that lapsed bequest goes. The same thing with section B, which leaves all of the personal property to Glenn Rhodes. Again, he predeceased the decedent. Oddly, the decedent left the phrase in equal shares following A and B, even though there's not a second beneficiary listed there. So I think the court has to determine what happens to those lapsed bequests. Now, the anti-lapse statute says that if there are no descendants of the deceased beneficiary, the lapsed bequest has to pass to the residue or the residuary clause of the will. Well, there's no direction from the testator as to where they go. And if we assumed for a minute that it wasn't Glenn Rhodes listed in A and B, instead let's say it was Little Johnny, and Little Johnny survived, well, Little Johnny would have gotten the homestead. Little Johnny would have gotten all of the personal property, including the cash. And that would have left us then, what passes under paragraph C? Well, again, paragraph C, by the time we get to C, the homestead's gone, lapsed in our true situation, but in my analogy, it went to Little Johnny. All the personal property is gone, either lapsed or going to Little Johnny in my hypothetical. So by the time we get to C, the appellee wants you to focus on the portion, the words, the portion passing should go to Elise Kindler. But I submit to the court that by the time you get to paragraph C, focus on the rest of my estate. Because when the decedent wrote this, she intended that A, would have already disposed of her homestead, B, would have already disposed of her personal property. If there was anything left, it would have passed under Article C. But again, the simplest way to have written this would have been to say, I leave everything in my estate to Glenn Rhodes. Well, she didn't do that either. So we have to interpret the words that are there.
Let me ask you a question, please.
Yes.
In your brief, you state that harmonizing all of the words in paragraph C without any edits or additions yields only one logical conclusion. Decedent intentionally elected not to pass any property under paragraph C. If that's the case, then why mention Elise Kindler or Michael Kindler at all?
That's a good question, Your Honor. If, and in that portion of the brief, what I asked the court to focus on were the words as follows in the second line, because under the doctrine of a usedom generis, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, we're taught that the use of specific words controls over the use of general words. And one interpretation of paragraph C is that because she failed to list anything specifically after as follows meant that for whatever reason she intended that nothing pass under Article C. But if the court, again, the trick here is we're supposed to harmonize all the words. So the court's got to figure out what did as follows mean. Was it an attempt, as we stated, one interpretation was that the decedent wanted to limit the bequest to Glenn Rhodes to be simply what she was going to insert after as follows. Or if those words are deemed to be superfluous, then we're still left with paragraph A, the homestead's gone, paragraph B, the personal property is gone, and if the decedent had anything else, she chose for the first time to put Elise Kindler's name in there. We don't know why, of course, because we don't have the decedent to testify. But I think one interpretation of paragraph C is because she used the limiter as follows, yet did not list anything, showed an intent not to let anything pass under that paragraph.
So what you're saying is the logical conclusion that you're talking about is if you use as follows and then nothing follows it, then that's tantamount to nothing is conveyed.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The court issued an opinion in 2003, Steger versus Munster Drilling, and it cited in the briefs, and it says that a latter clause must be deemed to affirm, not contradict, an earlier clause. Well, under the appellee's interpretation, we're going to ignore D altogether because it doesn't fit the narrative, and instead we're going to pretend that Article C, Section C, is the operative provision. But if the will is unambiguous, as everyone believes in this case, then we have to interpret all the words. And I submit to the court that if that's what we're going to do, if the will is unambiguous, the only way that you can rule that the trial court was correct and that everything passes to the appellee is to make the severe changes that I have shown on the second page of the handout that the court has. The italicized words are what was in the will. The parts that are struck out are the parts that I believe you have to strike, and the parts that are underlined are the parts that I believe you have to add, none of this editing is allowed by Texas law. But if you add those words, you can make sure that the Section A lapsed bequest passes to C, that the Section B lapsed bequest passes to C, and that therefore everything in C passes to Elise Kindler, and D basically means nothing. But D is there. The decedent put D there, and the decedent put D there for a reason, and we have to assume that the decedent did it for a specific reason. So under the appellee's view, there's something wrong with this that requires editing. Under the appellant's view, while the will is a little bit hard to understand, it's not difficult, it's not impossible, and the decedent made clear that any other property, which is going to pick up anything that lapsed in A, anything that lapsed in B, has to pass in D to the heirs at law. This is not a situation where the heirs were simply a default if everybody else was dead, like you see in a lot of wills. This was a specifically mentioned bequest to heirs. the appellee's argument that, well, if you do it this way, Elise Kindler gets nothing. Elise Kindler would have gotten nothing if Glenn Rhodes had survived. She also would have gotten nothing if Glenn Rhodes had survived and gone into a been in a nursing home under Article 5, which the appellee wants you to use, because Elise Kindler still had to survive Glenn Rhodes in order to inherit. So the purpose of this court, the purpose of the trial court, is not to make sure Elise Kindler gets something. It's to try to use the words the decedent wrote down and interpret what they mean and what the most logical conclusion is based on those words, with no edits, no additions, and no strikeouts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Branion. Mr. Norrell?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to address opposing counsel's issue with respect to rightness first, and just remind the panel, as Justice Walker pointed out, that the case law that has been presented by the appellants with respect to construing Civil Practice and Remedies Code Section 37.004 as to justiciability of a will, particularly in this case where procedurally we had cross motions for summary judgment, both sides had filed their motions, both sides had agreed to an argument and a hearing with a court reporter. The testatrix in this case clearly had predeceased long before, and it had always been the party's position that the cross motions for summary judgment could solve any justiciable question, because no one had argued as to the authenticity or the validity of the will itself. In fact, the same will was attached to appellant's motion for summary judgment, as was attached to appellee's motion for summary judgment when we had the motions. That is our position in the brief to the court when we state that appellants cannot present case law to justify their position that they're asking the court to make today.
How do you know that somebody wasn't just going to come forward with a new will? I mean, until the will's admitted into probate, it's not established as the last will and testament. There's still an opportunity for someone else to come forward and say, hey, she wrote something the night before she died. You know, I mean, so isn't there a good policy reason why you want to admit the will to probate first and establish that it is the last will and testament before you start interpreting the document?
Justice Sotomayor, I think that is a good question, and my answer would be this. I think there's a good policy reason to have the will probated in the probate case. And as the court is aware, there had been an appeal actually brought by appellants earlier that had been dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, and the will was ultimately probated. I would posit to the court, Your Honor, that it's not necessary to have the will technically probated when all parties to the case have agreed as to the authenticity and the validity of the will. Opposing counsel stated in his opening arguments that in support of that policy approach, you can't just take a will that's been typed up and ask a trial judge to make a ruling on motions for summary judgment. But if all the parties have agreed that that is the will in dispute, then we would say that judicial economy actually dictates that you can go ahead if everyone has agreed to cross motions to get the terms of the will construed. And Your Honor, in this situation, there were a couple of reasons procedurally why that played out, because both parties had amended what started off as an initial will probate, ended up with amended petitions by both parties, actually amended by appellants first, asking for declaratory relief. So while I would answer the court and say yes, it certainly has to get resolved at the trial court level, I still don't see anything in 37.004 that requires it be admitted to probate.
And the bottom line would be that the declaratory judgment, the declaration as to what this particular will means would not be preclusive of a subsequent will being offered to probate when this one is, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly correct.
You say that they have not produced any case law to support their position that the will had to be admitted into probate first. What is your best case that you cited in your brief that stands for or has a ruling that in fact the will doesn't have to be admitted into probate before such a declaration?
And Justice Gabriel, we did cite the Florence case because I literally researched every annotated opinion to 37004. That was the closest case on point on this issue, Your Honor.
But that was the one where the person was not deceased yet. So it is factually distinguishable. So if they can't cite one and you can't cite one, it's because there are no cases. Would
Judge,
you agree?
Yes, ma'am. And our position would be that you have to look at the statute. And I believe that's what we ended up concluding in our SIR reply brief. That the language of and when I say statute, I'm not referring to the estates code or the probate code in this case, but rather 37.004, that when it says that any party that has a question as to the validity or construction of a will, there is no language that caveats that as to justiciability or that says pursuant to any restrictions placed by the estates code or the probate code. With the court's
But wouldn't a more specific statute trump a more general rule with regard to declaratory judgments? Declaratory judgment is broad. The estates code is very narrow, dealing with estates only. So wouldn't that be a more specific statute that would trump the Declaratory Judgment Act?
Your Honor, I would agree with that statement if the Civil Practice and Remedies Code statute used in this case was a broader deck action statute. But we actually used 37004 because it literally specifically expressly referenced wills. And that would be my answer.
But not only wills. You can construe contracts and agreements
right.
and so forth.
That's right.
Okay.
But again, because the word wills was put in there, and following up with Justice Gabriel's comments that we are not here asking the court to try to make new law on justiciability construction of 37004 prior to a will being probated. We are saying that the statutory language allows that right now. Moving on to the construction of the will with the court's permission. Counsel has stated that our position is asking the court to ignore paragraph B. Appellee's position is that the entire Article 3 would not have been written if the testatrix had not intended that every provision of that be given validity. We've sided the court with the recent Hysaw versus Dawkins opinion, and in that case, in our SIR reply brief, the Supreme Court just in January stated a holistic approach aimed at ascertaining intent from all words of the conveying instrument has to be taken, and that you can't take one particular phrase from one line of a will out of context. I'll just address directly the issue, which is the wording of paragraph C, and specifically all the rest of my estate of whatsoever kind and wheresoever situated as follows to Glen Rhodes, period. Appellees have asserted this in their brief, that the description of the estate property in that sentence is all the rest of the estate, whatsoever kind, wheresoever situated. And therefore, there was no need to have a subsequent list or attached Exhibit A or itemized added description. And instead, that the intended relief, as when it applies to as follows, means to Glen Rhodes. The court has our briefs, but essentially, the question is this will going to fall under an anti-lapse statute because paragraph C of Article 3 only has a provision to go to Ms. Kindler attached, whereas paragraphs A and B do not. And to assist the court in construing that, the answer to that question, we would point the court not only to paragraph C, but also, as we've already done in our briefs, to the trust that had been contemplated for Glen Rhodes had he not predeceased the testatrix in this case. And in that trust, the language specifically contemplated that Appellee would be named as the trustee and that the portion, it literally says, even I direct that his portion as described in Article 3 above. And then it goes on down and says that if this trust had been necessary and Mr. Rhodes had passed and everything had subsequently passed to Ms. Kindler via the trust, it would have been everything that Mr. Rhodes had received. So our position to the court, trying to use the Hysaw opinion, is that the court should not look only at paragraph C under Article 3, but rather the trust provision. And I would also point out that Ms. Kindler had also been named executor of the will. And why is that important? Because Ms. Kindler is the only named beneficiary under the will, as we hear today. When Mr. Rhodes passed, the heirs at law, counsel was relying upon the residuary clause to say there was a lapse, and we can't have that, and the paragraph under Article 3 is no good, and therefore we step in.
Aren't you asking us to look at the trust provision and the fact that she was named executor as evidence of the testator's intent?
Justice Gabriel, I would answer it this way. In the Hysaw opinion, they said any apparent inconsistencies or contradictions must be harmonized to the extent possible by construing the document as a whole.
And they also say specifically, intent must be drawn from the will, not the will from the intent, and that you have to look at the language. Aren't you asking us to draw the will from the intent rather than the intent from the will? Because you're asking us to completely ignore paragraph D. You're asking us to ignore that the word portion means a part of a whole, and that that's used in paragraph C, and find that paragraph C passes everything to the appellee. Tell me where I'm wrong in that.
No, Your Honor. When put in that context, we are certainly, number one, asking the court to construe portion as meaning a whole, and we're asking the court to look to the other parts of the will to get there, including the trust provision. With respect to testator intent, yes, ma'am, I would say we are asking that as part of the analysis, and here's why. Article 3, which says estate disposition, would not have been put in there. Justice Souter brought this up earlier, Your Honor, when opposing counsel was giving primary argument, and that being, why would this language be in here? Why would Elise Kindler's name be put in there if it was never intended that that be funded with estate assets?
Why would D be put in there then if her intent was to pass everything using the word portion to Ms. Kindler?
My answer, Judge, is that was put in there as a standard residuary clause. Should there have been anything unknown or unexpected that might have come up during the probate proceeding? Court has no further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Norrell. Mr. Brandon, rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to address something quickly. I believe that counsel for the appellee has argued basically the waiver argument that was first brought up in the appellee's brief. I addressed that in appellant's reply. The position, as I understand it, is because we also sought summary judgment that we somehow made an agreement that the will was valid and was ready for the court to construe it. That's not the case. As we point out in our reply brief, waiver has never been argued in this case. It was never presented to the trial court. And in fact, our concerns regarding the rightness of the prospect of this will were raised at the trial court in our response to the motion for summary judgment. But once counsel for appellee files their motion for summary judgment and it's clear that the court is going to have a hearing, the only choice available for appellants is to file a counter motion, but also address the fact that, Judge, this is not right. As is evident from the brief, the trial court was apparently concerned about it. He asked questions about it on the record. He asked counsel for both parties to file written briefs by a certain date. Appellants did that, appellees didn't, and the trial court made a ruling actually before the appellees filed theirs, if one was going to be filed. So waiver is an improper argument because it was never brought to the trial court and it can't be raised first on appeal. But there is no waiver here because the very argument of the juxtaposition of Section 94 of the Probate Code, it either means something or it doesn't. If a will isn't a will until it's admitted to probate, then it doesn't matter the word used in the declaratory judgments statute, because will is a term of art. A will is just a piece of paper until it's been admitted, and that's why Section 94 is in the code.
What language of Section 94 do you think requires the will to be admitted to probate in order to obtain a declaratory judgment? I understand that Section 94 says that title can't pass, but that's not what the trial court did. The trial court didn't pass title to any property. The will obviously still subsequently has to be admitted to probate. But what language in Section 94 prohibits a declaratory judgment action?
Well, Your Honor, if Section 94 says that a will is not effectual for passing title to property, then it's not effectual for anything. What else is a will? A will, the only purpose of a will is to provide a link in the chain of title between the dead person and the beneficiaries. The appellees in their declaratory judgments action requested a certain interpretation of the will so that title to all of the decedent's property would pass to appellee. That's exactly the relief requested. Otherwise, Your Honor, it's an advisory opinion. We could take a contract that we're thinking about signing and ask a court to, judge, tell us what you think this paragraph means before we move forward and execute it, before this becomes a valid binding contract on both parties. That's an advisory opinion. And I submit that if that's not what Section 94 means, it has no meaning, because it doesn't pass title, it doesn't appoint an executor, doesn't appoint a trustee, it does nothing. Because, frankly, Your Honor, a person may have a dozen wills during their lifetime. Not a single one of them means a thing until A, they die, and B, it's admitted to probate. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We very much appreciate your argument. It's been very helpful to the court as well as your briefing. Your case is submitted, and we will take a few minutes and allow the next case to move up to counsel table.